This episode is brought to you by the Nick Taylor Horror Show. Now, are you a horror director or an aspiring horror director? Would you like to get free filmmaking advice from some of the latest and greatest names in horror history? Well, you are in luck because the Nick Taylor Horror Show podcast is your go-to masterclass in horror filmmaking. Featuring interviews with guests like Joe Dante and Mick Garris, Roger Corman, William Lustig, Bill Moseley, and Mitzi Peroni, each episode of Nick Taylor Horror Show explores and deconstructs the success strategies of established horror directors while summarizing the key insights and resources that you can use for your own filmmaking journey. This includes their creative process, strategies for getting the first films off the ground, favorite books and tools, key life lessons, and much, much more. Download and subscribe to the Nick Taylor Horror Show today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere you listen, or visit nicktaylor.com for more information.
Vinegar Syndrome October lineup has finally been unveiled. From the creator of Beyond the Door and The Visitor, aka the greatest holy fucking shit movie ever made, comes Beyond the Door 3, better known in some circles as Amok Train. This totally batshit crazy Euro gore fest features flesh-melting decapitation by train, impaling Bo Svenson, and a toothless witch. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. If low-budget high-sleaze 80s camping slashers are your thing, the never-on-disc sleeper Berserker should give you everything you crave and maybe more, Turek. Plus, one of the great forgotten horror gems to emerge from England in the 80s and unofficially set in or inspired by the Friday the 13th universe, Unmasked Part 25, makes its disc debut in startling clarity. Yeah, that one looks pretty bonkers. Giving you a great opportunity to enjoy its plentiful drippy kills and heartfelt monologues. But being October, Vinegar Syndrome can't just bring you the usual tally of four films. So instead, to make this Halloween season extra special, brace yourself for the Amityville Cursed Collection box set, which brings together Amityville, The Evil Escapes, It's About Time, from Hellbound director Tony Randall, and It Is About Time, New Generation, and perhaps most notoriously, Dollhouse. Gosh, if that's notorious, I hate to think. All in brand new 4K restorations. This four-film collection, along with all other October releases, will only be available for purchase on VinegarSyndrome.com. And while you're on the site, be sure to sign up for the almost monthly newsletter to stay on top of exclusive deals, promotions, and other surprises. Make sure to come say hello at Cinema Wasteland, Monster Mania, Chiller, and other festivals near you.
Okay, welcome to episode 161 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob G. It's me and Elric Kane.
I'm still here.
What's up, man?
We are healthy humans.
Glad you can make it. Ernie's here too. Our recording engineer is always here. More faithful than most on this show.
I think Beck ate a bad popcorn.
Is that where we're going with?
I think so. We were at a screening. We won't say which screening, but there could have been some popcorn just lying around, and Becca's like crawling through the floorboards, eating what she can find, and sometimes you get a sore stomach. It's a bad move.
It's the gamble you pay if you eat off, off the floor. It's fine. How are you doing?
I'm good. Okay. Getting ready for October. I'm feeling it. I'm bracing myself. I'm looking at dates, kind of getting a little worried. There's a lot of travel involved. But I'm not trying to jump the gun here, but I did start watching some Tales from the Crypt episodes. I'm not going to get into the what, but let me just say, I haven't watched Tales from the Crypt really in any more than like a random passing in about 12 years probably.
Okay.
And it is the perfect thing to set the tone.
Do you hear that?
It sounds like it could be the other Crypt Keeper.
Let's see if this works. Hello.
Well, hello.
Oh, my God. Oh, is that a surprise appearance?
For Halloween, no less?
Are we live?
We are live right now.
Holy crap.
Wow.
What's up, gentlemen?
What's going on? Becca is
bad popcorn.
Out. Bad popcorn is apparently the story we're going with.
Is that the sequel to Popcorn?
Bad Popcorn, yeah. I'd watch that.
There's our host, Ryan Turek. Wow, how nice of you to check in,
buy a bag, go home, and throw up into the toilet.
Exactly.
Yes. I mean, she does have every barf bag known to man from...
No, that's very true. Well,
where have you been, Turek? What the hell? Where have you been?
Well, you know, shooting Halloween kills over here in lovely Wilmington, North Carolina.
Hey. What are you on, day seven now?
Yeah, we're on day seven.
That's
pretty
cool. Yeah. How's it going?
We switched over to nights this week.
Yeah.
So I am going to be a vampire for a little while. But yeah, it's going well so far. Going very well.
Any David Gordon Green gossip? What's he like from the snack table? What's going on?
No, it's actually a lot of fun, because if you guys haven't watched Righteous Gemstones, it's fun to watch Righteous Gemstones on Sunday night on HBO and then come in the next day and, you know, just geek out with the team about how some jokes played and and how some jokes came about and all that stuff. It's a lot of fun.
You've got to force them to come on the show. They've got to come, both of them.
I know. Well, we've got this and then one more movie. So, I mean, and let me just clarify. We are not shooting these back to back.
Okay, so you're coming back. You're coming back after the shoot, at least for a few months.
I will be back after the shoot. Okay. Yeah, we're supposed to wrap at the end of October.
Okay.
But, yeah, it's going well, but guys, I miss you guys. Oh, I miss Shockwaves. I miss our listeners.
Do you listen while you're away? Or do you have the fear of missing out listening? Yeah, or does that frustrate you?
Yeah, do you yell at it at us?
I do listen to it. I count every time I'm not mentioned on the show.
Right.
So just so you know.
Makes sense.
But no, you guys are doing a great job, and the interviews are fantastic, and I'm having fun. But no, it's my morning commute to listen.
Cool.
When I go to the set. My evening commute.
Do you have time to watch anything while you're in the middle of this Halloween kill shoot?
You know, funny that you should say that.
Nice.
There was a time in pre-production where I was just like watching so much. And then I just got I had a screener link to Three from Hell, and I meant to get into that, and I didn't get a chance to. So I think the link expired. Because I was actually going to try to go to the theater. It was playing here in town for three nights. And we just wrapped too late. But hey, it's all good.
You have seen some stuff.
Yeah. Hang on. I'll give you the lowdown.
I don't know if people can hear this at home, but I love that it sounds like you are literally in the middle of wilderness. Like, I just hear crickets.
Yeah, I hear the crickets too.
That's it sounds like you are in a Halloween movie.
I am walking through the streets of Haddonfield right now.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, no, my biggest takeaway from this year that I absolutely love is Belzebuth on Shudder.
Oh.
I mean, holy crap. Real surprise. I mean, I had a couple of people recommend it to me, said it's incredibly ambitious, if, you know, not entirely successful because they were kind of, you know, burdened by a low budget. But I just love the attempted scope of this movie and the big ideas that it has, because it's basically about these mass murders that are occurring, and the Mexican police detective who's trying to discover why these murders are taking place. And he basically teams up with Tobin Bell, who's like a demonologist. Yeah. And together they discover that the devil has a secret plot to prevent the reincarnation of Jesus. And it is just fantastic. I love this shit. There's some really, really great scares in it. And, I mean, like, I was just like totally taken by its creativity and its ambition. I really dug it. So if anybody out there wants something fresh to see, Belzebuth is definitely it.
And that's a Shudder original?
Yeah, it's a Shudder original. That the opening scene, by the way, is pretty hardcore.
it's super haunting. Super haunting. I mean, there's a couple scenes in this movie that are just like, I say like the first 30 minutes are incredibly intense. And not for the, you know, not for the weak hearted at all. Yeah. But, so I saw that. I'm a big fan of American Horror Story, 1984.
Oh, I haven't
so
checked
far.
In yet. Okay. So it's the 80s one, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's right
one.
Up your alley.
Yeah. No, that one's fantastic. It's off to the right start. It's got aerobics, it's got VCRs, it's got slashers, it's got summer camp vibes. It's a lot of fun.
Cool. I'll check in with you episode 8.
What else? Oh, and then the funny thing is people who follow me on Letterboxd noticed that I revisited Halloween 5 and Halloween Resurrection back to back.
Oh.
And everybody was like, wait a minute, are there clues here? And I was like, absolutely not.
Yeah.
It was just an attempt to revisit those Halloween entries that I don't turn to year after year. And there's a reason.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Oh, I'm going to talk about people following our Letterboxd and interpreting things.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I know. It's getting in the way.
Well, you don't do stars, right, Ryan? You just
No.
Log
I put that in my profile, too. I said, you know, this is just purely a personal log of stuff that I watch for reference points and, you know, in case I need to kind of dip back and find a director or something like that. When was the last time you guys saw Sorority Row, the remake?
Oh, no, the remake. I saw the original not long ago when that new disc came out. I think in theaters was the only time I saw it.
Yeah, it was the last time I saw it was in theaters, too. There's kind of this strange thing happening on Twitter where people are, and I think it's just another generation being very vocal about those films that they grew up with. So, you know, Cursed, I saw recently, everybody was like, Wes Craven's Cursed doesn't get enough love. And I'm like, that's because it's really, really bad. But Sorority Row popped up, and I was like, you know what? I think I didn't give that one a fair shake. Mm. So I revisited it, and I think it's got a strong start. It's got all of the ingredients to, you know, kick off a fun body count whodunit. But then, first off, it's way too long. Secondly, by the last 30 minutes, you just don't care about anybody.
Is it the one where they accidentally kill one of their sorority mates at the start and get rid of the body?
Yeah. Yeah, they try to – well, they prank. It's a prank.
That's right. Yeah, it's a prank. Yeah, and Princess Leia?
They're trying
– Carrie Fisher.
Yeah, Carrie Fisher.
That's right.
But they try to – basically what they try to do is they're trying to prank one of the boyfriends, and they make it seem like this girl got roofied and then she overdosed. And then the sorority sisters, you know, come together and tell this kid, we're going to bury her body. Let's go. You know, you're at fault. So now we need to get rid of the corpse. And then they go to get rid of the corpse. And, you know, the girl is obviously still alive. But then this kid makes a rash decision and actually kills this girl. He's like trying to dismember the corpse. So he actually kills the girl who was involved in the prank. So now they're like, oh, shit, now we really have to get rid of a body. And from that point on, it's kind of, you know, it does this kind of I Know What You Did Last Summer plot turn where, you know, 5 months later, they're getting ready to graduate and they got this dark secret. But then that's, you know, a couple, like I'd say about 20 minutes after that kind of goes off the rails. But
that one feels like the end of that cycle. Would that be right? Like, you know, that cycle, where, like you're saying, I Know What You Did Last Summer, there weren't many after Sorority Row.
Sorority Row was more of the end of that remake cycle.
Yeah.
So there was like The Hills Have Eyes, When a Stranger Calls, Prom Night, and Sorority Row was kind of the tail end of that.
Even though it's nothing like the original. If people haven't seen the original, that's a wild movie. It's a really cool movie.
Yeah, because that was 2009, so that's, you know, 10 years after the I Know
But it still feels more like them than the remake movies, you know what I mean, in terms of story. But yeah.
Yeah. And then what else did I get caught up with? Oh, I saw Color Out of Space.
Oh, ooh. I'm going to see that tomorrow, so don't say too much.
I won't say too much. I will say that I commend Richard Stanley for pulling something off. That was, incredibly fun and fresh and colorful and reintroducing the color purple to H.P. Lovecraft movies.
Oh, cool, yeah.
It's got some pacing issues, but I kind of wish they kind of toned back Nick Cage a little bit, but there's some weird and wild fucking shit in this movie, and it's definitely worth checking out, especially from a guy who hasn't directed in so long.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, I truly commend him for, like, you know, kicking off the rust and rolling up his sleeves and just showing what's rattling around in his weird, weird fucking brain. But it's good. I mean, like, I'm presuming you guys are going to Beyond Fest.
He is. I'm not. But.
You're going to something there probably, right? But tomorrow, I've got the – it's the opening night film.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah, they're kicking it off with that and Daniel Isn't Real. So we had Adam on last week or 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, that was a good interview, gents.
Yeah,
good
that was
interview.
A fun one, yeah. And we got to the bottom of Death Wave.
I think that's why I hit – fast forward.
No.
I'm kidding.
That was the juicy stuff.
All right, guys, I'm really sorry, but I have to run back. I got to run back.
It's okay. We understand.
We just want to wish you luck.
No.
Hey, have you met Anthony Michael Hall yet? Anthony Michael Hall?
What's it? I'm looking at him.
Oh, okay. Oh. I see him.
I'm staring at him.
I'll give you a message for him later.
Tell him how much I loved the Dead Zone show. That's my Rob G. Yes, absolutely.
Well, hey, I love that technology worked in 2019, and I can actually call into the show. Maybe we'll do this more often.
Yeah.
Sounds
hope
good.
So. All right, man. Thanks for checking in, buddy.
Well, thanks, everybody. All right. Thanks, guys. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Take care.
I'll talk to you later. Bye.
All right.
Anthony Michael Hall. That's the most genius piece of casting, I think, in a long time.
I agree with you.
I love it.
I'm a big fan.
Like, it makes me – I'd watch all franchises of him coming back into horror films, you know?
So there you go. You heard from one of our co-hosts, thankfully,
yes.
Who was able to chime in. What do you want to delve into first?
I was finishing off basically setting that when he called the Crypt Keeper I was talking about. Just rewatching some Tales from the Crypt is – I highly recommend. They're all on Amazon if you haven't got discs yet. Unfortunately, you're paying per episode of $1.99 or like $15 per season or something. And because I'm kind of just cherry picking right now, because we are going to be doing a show with the Crypt Keeper
October 11th
at Salem. Yep, and it's just the two of us at the stage. We are counting down our five favorite episodes, five faves in quote marks. But I really want to actually, it's putting me in the mood to rewatch all of it because they're so short. My brain remembered them as 45 minute episodes.
No, I think they were, 30 minutes each?
No.
Roughly?
Dude.
22?
My favorite one is 20 minutes, and most of them are about 25.
Yeah.
And it blew my mind because when I was younger watching these, I just remember them as hour-long things.
No, they're short.
They are short and in a great way where they feel – there's only one that when it ended, I was like, oh, they could have gone on another 20 minutes and I would have been good. But it's really – I highly recommend this for your – you know, the launch to the Halloween feeling, because we're always looking for the right mood to set the tone.
These are perfect.
Especially because I haven't seen them in so long. I'm really enjoying this. I'm going to keep doing it past the picks we've made.
Yeah, it's been a few years, but a couple years ago, I got all seven seasons, and it took me from like September all the way to about Christmas, and I would just watch one or two a night.
Yeah.
And I went in chronological order, and I even enjoyed, because the last season is all British. I went back and like, cause I remember I didn't like it when it
aired.
Why
is that?
They were at the tail end and trying to save money. But you go back and it's like Bob Hoskins and like Ewan McGregor and I'm fairly sure Daniel Craig's in what, like everyone that you recognize now from that scene is in it.
Interesting. And Freddie Francis, I think, directs one and that must be why. Cause I remember him directing one episode. It's probably cause he's in England, you know, he's been around forever. But yeah, I really liked it. And there's a great article. So a shout out to a Twitter person and film lover and blogger and writer, Stephanie Crawford.
Yeah.
She read a really good article. I think it's called like the Exhumed something of Tales from Crypt, but she's been, I guess, been going through them all, and she went in depth highlighting the best episodes per season. And I use that age to remember the ones I already liked. Most of them are ones from my classic, but there's one she did put in my ear that I hadn't seen and that did make the list. I won't say what it is yet, but it's a really cool one. And so I love that there's people out there doing that hard work so we can just glide and off their coattails.
Well, I know I picked, as you'll know when we get to the live episode, I went distinctly with what there was always a twist or an actor or something that stood out in my mind where if you just said, oh, the one with so-and-so, I'd be like, oh, I know exactly which episode you're talking about. So that's how I went about it. We have to mention, I mean, Elric, Ryan mentioned he almost went to see Three from Hell, and we have lost Sid Haig this last week.
Right.
And we can't let the show go by without mentioning.
And he was sick. You know, he was obviously sick a couple weeks ago. So I guess in my brain, I was assuming this would happen then. And it was nice to remember, like, you know, I posted that show. I have not looked at the video show I've done literally since probably we've been doing Killer POV. So it's been like literally seven years.
Yeah.
I haven't even rewatched any of that. Part of it is because it feels weird to look at yourself on video. And it's just I was never as comfortable being on camera.
Yeah.
But that, from my memory, my two favorites were Jeff Combs. Anytime I've done anything with Jeff, I've had the best time of my life. But Sid's, it was just me. Stacey Lane Wilson, who was the other co-host, wasn't there. It was just Becca was the chat girl. She was in the chat thing answering. And Sid, and it was just a super fun, low-key chat. And I remember really loving him, thinking he was like the coolest dude, smart as hell, learned that he ran for president, all this crazy shit. It was a mesmerizer. You know, he's a hypnotist, a trained hypnotist. So we posted that somewhere in our group if anyone wants to watch it, but he's just seemed like such a cool guy. And then I would met him a few times after that, and he always totally remembered who you were.
Yeah,
he was really good like that. I just also love him in movies. Like, I was always a Spider Baby fan, Coffee fan.
Coffee and Foxy Brown, that double bill and having the him with Pam Grier. And even that little story about them reuniting for Jackie Brown, because I think you were the one who told me that.
How Quentin didn't tell
Pam Grier that he was the judge.
So she walked into the scene and reacted, initially, like, with just a burst of tears, kind of like,
because they hadn't seen each other in 10, 20 years.
Because people do forget before Twitter and this shit. That happened.
Yeah,
you could not know what happened to someone.
Yeah.
Like, we're not in that world anymore. Like, anyone you want to know what happened to them, you'd look them up, you find out where they are, you can say hi. But there was a time it's like, shit, I wonder where that person lives. I wonder what, especially with their careers. I remember it might not have been this episode that I recorded. I did have him on the show I did before that called This Week in Horror. And I remember him telling me the reason he was a hypnotist is there, like, a lot of these people. And in the 80s, the career just went away, completely dried up. No one's casting you, and you have to find something else to do. So he retrained and became a hypnotist therapist and started doing that for a while until
that's
the
insane.
Offer. It's kind of like how Robert Forster kind of, didn't have anything to do until Tarantino had to track him down for Jack Brown. So you realize it's pretty wild, the lives these people lived over a 50-year career. And if you can stay on top even and being reinvented at least a couple times like he was able to do. Obviously, Rob Zombie is the one who really just completely reinvented his persona.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, it's it was nice to see. I mean, of course, I'm sad he's not with us, but it's nice to see the just overwhelming love for that guy. Mm. Just as a human being, and he was always on the convention circuit. So, it's nice that he was appreciated by genre fans.
Yeah, clearly he was one of those guys. I think I remember us going to one of these conventions where the line was forever and he never gets up. There's a guy who will sign it until it's over. Like, he just kept going, didn't get up for a break. Somebody else from the convention circuit even told me, like, there's no one like Sid Haig the way he does that for his fans.
Yeah.
But he also just is unusual. It also brings me back to the kind of actor I'm really drawn to, which is people who look a little unusual, who don't fit this, like, I just cannot stand this modern CW fucking casting where it's like, oh, TV stars, and then let's get them in movies, and everyone looks the same.
Yeah.
And I think at some point I'm worried we're going to start losing the people in the generation, like the Gene Hackmans. Where's the leading men who are Gene Hackman, right? And Sid Haig had that. He's a big guy, weird look, but he somehow maximized in lots of different ways. So, yes, here's to Sid, could have been president.
Yeah.
We'd happily have you back.
Yeah. Should we talk about what we saw last night?
Yeah. I mean, two of my most anticipated films, actually, I've got on tap. Lighthouse was my most anticipated film of this year, I got to say. Like, it was the one I was just, I guess, most curious about. I remember hearing it had done very well at Cannes. Critically, I knew it was shot in black and white. I knew it was shot in the middle of nowhere. Yeah, full frame, which is super weird going into the cinema and seeing three quarters of the screen gone. Yeah. And you're like, oh, why is
this? And
this
is obviously Robert Eggers who did The Witch. So we've been highly waiting for him to do a new movie.
Yeah. And it's production detail heavy. I've been loving the work Pattinson's been doing of late. And Willem Dafoe, is a master. Last time we saw him in black and white was Shadow of a Vampire. So this is all good signs. It is a hell of a movie. It is incredibly commercial. It's going to be a home run.
Oh, you are being completely sarcastic right now.
Definitely look at each other after again. This might be the least commercial movie
ever made.
Yeah,
I'm going to give credit to A24 because they are backing a vision for sure. I mean, nobody can make movies like Robert Eggers.
Yeah, that's very specific.
I don't know if I really liked this one as a movie. I enjoyed the experience.
Yeah.
I think the acting is terrific.
Yeah.
I mean, Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe, because it's mostly just them. The level of detail, the sound design, like there's, but I wasn't necessarily scared at any point. There's only like one maybe thing that kind of caught me off guard, but for the most part, I don't really consider it a scary movie. It was more of a mood movie.
And a madness movie.
Yeah. I don't think. If you didn't like The Witch, I highly doubt you're going to like this at all.
I mean, well, you could not like The Witch and like this if The Witch wasn't your kind of movie. But if it was the pacing, you're right. Like I think you said afterwards, it makes The Witch look like Die Hard, which I think should be on the poster because that's a great fucking quote.
That's a great quote, but maybe Becca said that because I definitely didn't.
I'll take credit for it if it was Becca because she's sick.
But you said it was basically Wake and Fright.
It's literally. No, I mean, I felt very – because I know that film pretty well, and I was like, oh my god, this – film. If you've been listening to the show for a long time, you know I love this crazy Australian film, Wake and Fright, which is like largely about alcoholism and men getting together and just going off the rails. Imagine the scenes with the kangaroos and replace that with the seagulls. And you have a lot of the same concepts being explored, but especially the Willem Dafoe and Pattinson are very much like the main guy in Wake and Fright and Donald Pleasant's relationship. Like even some of the same things are on the similar trajectory. It's very much about two shut-ins. Like I didn't, when it ended, I agree. I didn't love it when I came out, but I liked it a lot. I respected the hell out of the way it's made. Like I was just like, oh my God, to make a movie this specific in a time like this, I have no idea. It feels like a Hungarian film or like November or something that we see with that kind of a vision.
See, when I walked out, it felt like somewhere between November and Wake and Fright and maybe that Twin Peaks The Return episode that's in black and white at the gas station. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like that tone.
For me, it was if I was going to pinpoint, I was going to go, it's Wake and Fright by way of Bergman's Hour of the Wolf. But Hour of the Wolf leans in harder into horror. Like I don't think some people who haven't seen it don't realize that Bergman made like a flat out horror film. Like it's not just like kind of. And this film flirts with horror. This film, I was telling somebody today that this is the interesting thing. If Robert Eggers wanted this to be the greatest Lovecraft movie ever made, he literally only had to have like two or three more scenes or go a little longer, and he has it. Like it would have been the movie we would all be talking about for the rest of horror fans forever of what how to do Lovecraft, but he doesn't care about making that movie. He's got build up to it, he's got moments, there's some really incredible like little sequences, and it's like we obviously don't want to spoil it because it's a film with only a few things like that, so I don't want to, you know. But I really believe he could just take those same bones, and if you filmed, like, you got 20 more minutes, here's the film, go back out and do what you want. You could literally, this would become one of those classic horror films, but it is only kind of a horror film.
Yeah.
Because it's much more about madness, it's much more about these characters, the isolation, and it's an odd film. It's the rhythmically odd, but there's some amazing set pieces in this thing. So yeah, I mean, I think some people this is going to be their movie of the year. It's going to blow their minds. And some people aren't going to even be able to watch this movie.
Well, so here's the funny thing. So there are people that listen to this are on the Shockwaves Horror Movie Club group, but please stop screen grabbing our Letterboxd and trying to figure it, because you, me and Becca had a completely different reaction to this movie. Yeah. All three of us.
Totally different.
And someone pointed out that we all gave it 3.5 stars on Letterboxd, which is ironic because my 3.5 is not the same as your 3.5.
No, and Becca's well I thought was going to be a 2 right, when we walked out.
I thought it was going to be 2 or 1.5. Yeah, I actually was leaning more towards 2. I was like split right down the middle. I was going to be 2.5, but on the way home, I just couldn't stop thinking about the performances.
Yeah.
And there was something stylistically about the way the picture and the sound design comes together.
That's next level.
On a technical level. Yeah. I just wish maybe there was a little bit more story or at least a clearer narrative that I could have latched onto. And so I ended up bumping it up from 2.5 to like 3.5.
And also keep in mind that score could change.
I can't stop thinking about it.
Like for me, I bet it will end up at 4 at some point because I'll remember it as a special piece of art. You know what I mean? But it doesn't mean I'm going to be rushing to rewatch quickly.
But like, it's hilarious that we all gave it the same grade technically.
It shows how inaccurate
that shit is.
We don't
feel that way at all.
Yeah, it shows how inaccurate that is. I mean, there is a couple aquatic horror moments that I think Becca probably would have appreciated, but I think if they'd pushed further on some of those, it would probably, but just the way it's mounted, and you know they probably built this lighthouse and the waves crashing around. But Willem Dafoe it definitely gives one of the best performances of the year I've seen. And Pattinson is almost equal to him. I think sometimes a little harder on some of the monologues and stuff for him, you know?
Yeah.
But Dafoe looks like he's born to talk like basically a pirate sea captain.
Is Dafoe acting at this point or is that just him?
But, I'll be very curious to see how this plays. I will say when I walked out, I remember just going, I can't see this film playing in Minneapolis in a mall.
Oh, no, it's not. I mean, that's what I meant. Totally it's like, bonkers. This is the least commercial thing that A24 has ever done.
Easily. Like, it makes, we walked out and I remember saying it makes Midsommar look like the most mainstream movie because Midsommar has young people going off to do young people things and maybe it's going to be exciting, you know, but this is not about that.
Yeah.
This is about, like, what's Willem Dafoe's cooking like, which is a good gag in the movie. So, we will not ruin it.
What? What?
Yeah.
What?
No, it's a wild movie, and I will definitely watch it again. I know that much.
Yeah.
Hey,
that's the lighthouse. I need time away from it now.
The other theory I have is the reason he probably, because for a long time he was meant to make Nosferatu first.
Yeah.
My theory is this is back to that Yuzna thing where it's like, if I don't make, I own the rights to Reanimator. If I don't make Reanimator 2 first, they're definitely going to let me make something in between. I get the feeling he did this one knowing this is going to be a much harder film to get made. Mm. He can get this one made, and everyone will still want Nosferatu if this does nothing. Because, like, just because you have Pattinson does not mean you've got a hit, because, like, High Life is a very similar kind of movie. It's very art house in space, and also good, also really well done, but a little off as well. So I think that this might be the film he makes in between. Maybe Nosferatu will be this crazy, you know. I think he suits making a film like Nosferatu.
Now I don't know. I don't know what that's going to be.
Yeah. No, it's...
But interesting.
He's keeping us on our toes. I'd love to get Eggers on here, obviously.
Yeah.
That one. But the other
that's
one...
That's The Lighthouse, and that comes out October 18th officially.
Okay, so that's sooner than I thought.
Yeah.
The other one, which I've been by one of my favorite directors of all time and one of your favorite directors of all time, I finally got to see Depraved... by Larry Fessenden.
Ooh,
and,
yes.
I thought I was going to get to see it on screen, so I've been kind of holding out. But I, you know, went in on VOD.
It's now out on VOD.
It is actually on VOD now. And this is a version of a Frankenstein type story, very modern in its approach, kind of looking at PTSD and the doctor in this particular story is a army medic, which is a great, really great portrayed character, I thought, portrayed by David Call, who I was unfamiliar with. But the standout star of this one is this guy, Alex Brough, who played Adam. And Adam is the Adam, as in Adam and Eve, is the guy coming who's being rebuilt from Super Dark Times. If you remember our love for that, there's an actor, Owen Campbell, who is in the start of this movie, and then something happens to him that makes him no longer in it, but it's still his mind kind of playing out throughout the visions of this film. So it's a really complicated take on like how the body parts, where they've come from, how they get assembled. But it's a funny film. It's like, I don't think it's his best. I know some people have said it's a bad. Habit is still just to me a masterpiece. Like, tonally, it's hard to touch. I think the last act of this one is still fun, but it loses a little bit of its focus from where you kind of want it to. It gets it back at the very end, but in a way, it kind of loses a little bit of a step, but it doesn't detract from the movie overall. But like, basically, this guy, Adam, he's being reconstructed, probably for like in a secret New York kind of warehouse, probably for a pharmaceutical kind of deal that's happening in the background, played by Blair Witch's Joshua Leonard, who's a fun, over-the-top kind of character in this one. But it's Adam, just the way he learns fast. He plays ping pong. He has flashbacks to a woman he loved, or a woman his brain loved, so not the guy he looks like.
Girl from the Ranger.
Oh, it is a girl from Ranger, yeah.
Yeah.
And this guy's face was just born to play the Frankenstein character. I mean, he's just got a fantastic look.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of like how Del Toro has wanted to do with Doug Jones. Mm-hmm. This guy's got a similar
long
body
face,
type. And, an aesthetic to him, yeah.
And I there's something about the way Larry shoots a movie that I love. I love how kind of it's kind of gritty, but it also has this really fun, you see like weird green lighting outside on the streets. There's a scene where this guy goes into it, you know, where the Frankenstein character's in a bar just talking to a girl, and I just love it. Because I know who's making this movie. When he has two characters just relating to each other, I think that's where Larry's work is at its finest. I really, really like this. This is definitely one of my faves of the year. And part of that isn't just that it's a great movie. It's just a really interesting movie. It's a movie that like keeps doing things that kind of defy, oh, I thought it was going to go this way. Okay, it's going this way. That's interesting. I like that, you know, when Larry does it. So sometimes when some directors do it, especially first-time filmmakers, it feels like a mistake. Mm. He seems interested in those parts, you know?
Yeah.
And always has in every one of his movies, you know? It's definitely a thumbs up for me. Definitely see it on VOD and support that Glass Eye Picks. Good stuff.
Yeah, cool. Depraved. Let's see. So I got from Arrow. I've been meaning to revisit this film for a really long time just because I have such vague memories of it. But it's Alice, Sweet Alice, which Arrow Video just put out on Blu-ray and
that is a
beautifully restored
film.
When was the last time you saw this thing?
I actually watched it It was on Amazon only about a year. I think it was last Halloween.
Yeah. Did it look all right on Amazon?
It was a good version. I think that's why I watched it. It might have been in HD. And I was like, it was creepier and better than I had remembered it for me.
Yeah. It is a wild movie that I'm still a little mixed on because it almost falls in that – and I haven't seen Don't Look Now in a long time. But almost in that camp of like not exactly horror, but I guess it's – it has a lot of Catholicism in it, a lot of imagery from the Catholic Church.
That's what I did for it. I did my triple feature, fuck Catholics. or fucking Catholics. Yeah, it was that and the Fulci with the priests falling.
Oh, my God.
Don't touch your duckling and something else. And the devils. That was my triple feature.
Oh, my God. That's quite something.
I remember that now.
But, yeah, so this is from 1976. Alfred Soul directed it. It's set in 1961 where there's these two twin sisters. It was originally called Communion. That's the title that comes up on the Blu-ray instead of Alice Who Dallas. And basically, kind of early on, they're taking their first communion, and one of the girls dies in a very mysterious way that you don't exactly – you see it, but you don't see who's responsible because the killer is always wearing this clear, creepy mask. And so it's implied, and we are assuming that one of the sisters is kind of evil and doing this sort of stuff. From there, it's like –
Brooke Shields.
Is it?
Brooke Shields is the girl.
Get out of here.
Yeah, that's her first thing.
Oh, my God. I didn't even not realize that.
I mean, double check for me while you're on there, but I remember that being the thing. Was that
you were
was
totally
Shields,
right. Yeah. I mean, and she's really young in it, so I totally forgot. Holy smokes. So, yeah. So, she's one of the girls, and basically from there, it almost becomes a little bit of a domestic drama because the father's out of the picture, but he comes back because of this, you know, the death of the girl. And it seems obvious to us that it's the sister, but the mom just like won't have any of it. And then from there, there's just like these really stark, crazy, what I would compare to what was going on in Italian cinema at the time, sequences. Like there's a stabbing on a staircase that's just so freaking creepy and effective and crazy. And a couple of plot twists along the way.
A beautiful neighbor. He's a lovely man. One of the most grotesque things I've ever seen.
Really, really gross, vile, fat guy.
Yeah, he's
just
weird.
Seems like a totally out of Jersey. And
feels like a molester.
I'm pretty sure that's what they were trying to imply. But I mean, it's really interesting. It almost felt like it's the closest I've seen to a New Jersey made Argento movie in that way.
It definitely has giallo vibes. For
it has the giallo vibe. And the disc is really cool too because they interview Alfred Soul on it, who had made one film before this that I think was a porno movie.
I think he's a production designer.
Yeah, something films. Like that. He was a production, or he became a production designer later on because he worked on some music video. But he had started out in adult films just to get into the business, and this was more his second film. And he kind of talks about the whole story of that. His cousin is a younger filmmaker named Dante Tomaselli, who's made a lot of interesting,
related, dude.
Weird movies. And in fact, makes sense to me that Dante was, you know, like six or seven when this movie came out, Alice Who Dallas. And he said it's always affected him deeply. And you could see a lot of the imagery from, especially a lot of the Catholic imagery.
Stuff, he goes from a neon and glowing things. And
It totally carries over. And in fact, Dante's been trying to remake this for a couple of years now. So hopefully he'll do it because he wrote a script with Fangoria's Michael Gingold. And so Michael Gingold's also on the disc walking us through all the original locations.
Oh, cool.
So it's a great disc. It's a really out there movie. It's kind of a – I'd call it an Italian – giallo gem from the 70s as by way of New Jersey.
Yeah.
Like that's where it's really coming from.
No, I really like this one. I did not realize it got the Blu-ray treatment recently.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a great disc. So Alice Sweet Alice, a.k.a. Communion.
I'm in. What else do you see?
Well, I am curious how you feel about this. Indicator, which is another label overseas that does primarily – they do region-free discs.
Yeah.
They had a big sale, so I picked up a bunch of stuff. And among the pile was a film I had never seen, which is the Michael Nichols movie Wolf, starring Jack Nicholson.
Oh, man. I haven't seen it since maybe I saw it maybe once after theaters, but I remember being very excited in theaters about it.
I feel like this is totally your movie.
I mean, at the time, I remember
it was weird.
All
I can think of is Elric.
I don't know. For some reason, I'm going to think it's going to be a Turek movie. I do love – well, I'm a Jack fan. So, like, Jack is
my
favorite.
Oh, I love Jack.
He's always been
my favorite. Of course. That's the start for starters.
All the main memories I have is him peeing on Spader during – as his, like – I would watch this one again. It has been a minute.
It's I had never seen it. I don't know why I'm it, but this was around the period that Coppola had done Dracula, mm-hmm. and then Kenneth Branagh had done Frankenstein, and then this was technically like of that trilogy.
Yeah.
This was the Wolfman version, but just called Wolf. And Jack Nicholson is a publisher named Will Randall, who kind of at the beginning is everything in his life is kind of in upheaval. He's about to get replaced by James Spader, the younger hotshot guy. His wife is having an affair. All this stuff is happening. And in the opening shot, he has an accident where he hits a wolf on the road, gets out of the car to go check on it, and it bites him on the hand. And then from there, obviously, I guess because it's Mike Nichols, it's all done in a very, well, Art House wouldn't be the
he is definitely not
classic
who you think
Hollywood
yeah,
way.
You don't think of him in horror.
No. Where like initially Jack starts to be able to smell things from a distance and hear conversations in other rooms. And like the way that they show his senses get heightened are kind of interesting. And then, of course, as you can guess, he's going to turn into sort of a werewolf.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of the weird, confusing part is that none of the characters fully wolf out. They kind of look like Wolverine. That's
does,
what I was kind of – and I don't know. Like Rick Baker did it. He did a great job. There's certain moments where he looks pretty darn cool and then others where he just looks really silly.
Yeah.
And you could definitely make out a lot of stunt people in werewolf makeup on this Blu-ray.
Wait, doesn't Spader become also one and then they start sparring?
There's some territoriality. Okay. I mean, he does piss on Spader. And so you know that's going to come back to bite him in the ass eventually.
It has been a long time for that one.
But no, it's – and Michelle Pfeiffer is the love interest, obviously. But it's a little weird because she's like the daughter of – so Christopher Plummer is his boss who owns the entire publishing company. And like Michelle Pfeiffer is his much, 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 much younger daughter that Jack like kind of has a thing with after his wife. And it's a little inappropriate to be honest, but it's Jack and it's the wolf and you know.
He's got pull back.
He's got pull back then. So I didn't love it. I didn't hate it. I thought it was a very interesting modern real take on what it would be to turn into a werewolf today. But me, like the old fashioned Wolfman fan of me just wants to see a werewolf, like fully formed. Rick Baker's on the disc, talking a little bit about the whole process. The movie's over 2 hours and there's tons of features on this. It's a good disc. It's definitely a good release.
If you want to add a fourth movie to those three, I would say in terms of tone, I'd add Devil's Advocate. I feel like it's kind of in that world. Like Devil's Advocate goes a bit bigger and over the top.
Yeah.
But if you want a devil movie to join those,
I haven't seen that in years either.
Yeah, no, it's that.
And
that
I
haven't seen.
I guess Hollow Man would be the Invisible
Man. I guess,
Man.
Your Hollow Man.
Where did that come out?
Because they're all kind of flawed, but they're all attempts at doing mainstream, big budget horror films with major actors. Which
is Hollow Man would be at the tail end of that because that was like 2000, where this was 90s, early 90s.
Yeah, and that one's like, oh, talk about like a terrible Me Too movie. Like, whew, Hollow Man's just like it's so incredibly, you know, the whole rapiness of it and stuff.
And they made a sequel.
You really?
They made a Hollow Man too.
No, I remember like, you know, often that's, there are movies where I don't pick that just probably because of my gender. I'm just literally watching it as a dumbass going, oh yeah, that's just a horror movie. But that was one where I was watching going, oh boy, I don't think this is okay. like I remember feeling like it. And I love Verhoeven as a director, but that is not the,
I haven't seen it in a
long
time.
I think there was
time.
A director's cut later and I never saw it. So maybe it was studio cut.
I
like
those. That's going to fix it.
Can this be our all-nighter? we're gonna put those five together as an all-nighter?
Sure, why not? So Indicator's got a great Blu-ray of it, of Wolf from 1994. I definitely recommend it. And that's it for me. Oh, I mean, the one thing I can talk about is that I did – Halloween season is full swing.
Yeah.
As last episode kind of indicated. And I went to Not Scary Farm, which is kind of one of the big horror attractions out here. Had an absolutely great time. It's always fun for me because, with Universal is like all the big name properties. Like they've got Stranger Things and Ghostbusters and all that stuff. I've always kind of preferred the homemade approach that's Not Scary Farm does because they get to be like very, very creative with their kind of, stuff. So, among the new, mazes. Let me just look it up here. But yeah, they definitely had a couple of really cool new mazes, including one that was like a Waxworks, and it was called it's called Waxworks, and basically it's kind of as if you're going through Waxworks with monsters and melted people. It's really freaking cool. They did that.
Do people chase you at this park?
Yeah, there's people out. Somewhere. Yeah, it's kind of very similar. Like, if you're just walking the grounds, there will be people in costume kind of running around like lunatics. And there's moments where just the fog starts to seep in, and that's when they really get you. It's really fun. I mean, I remember one time, because you can get a fast pass lane or, you know, front of the line sort of things, and that's what I tend to go for. And I remember I was telling my people, there was one year I went there, and there was a costume guy walking around being like, "Hey, you want to try the new ride?" And we're like, sure, what is it? He's like, "There's a maze right over this bridge," and it's like a little bridge that led to the other part of the park. And we're like, sure. He's like, "Yeah, follow me. And we're like, do we need a pass? He's like, "Don't worry about it. No line. And then we get to the other end of the bridge, and he was just like, "Suckers," and ran away. Like, there was no maze.
Wow, that's crazy.
So they definitely do fully embrace the trick part of trick or treat.
I'm going to shout out to that listener.
If he's listening. Actually, you know what? There was one time as well, a couple of years ago, I went with some of our crew, which included like Mike Mendez and James Wan was with us. And we were walking through a maze, and a scare actor jumped out and was like, "Oh, hey, what's up, James?" I like kind of broke character because he's so on.
That's pretty
awesome. I was like, "Come on, man."
Didn't you go with the actor from I Spit on Your Grave 3 this time?
Not 3, from the new one, I Spit on Your Grave, Deja Vu, my friend Jamie Bernadette. Yes.
Yeah. I know she listens. Oh, I think she listens, but I've seen her on their post. So it's just I recognize that person.
She's never been in one of those type of things, and I thought it'd be fun to take
that's
her.
That's funny.
Yeah. Shout out to Jamie. But yeah, Not Scary Farm is great this year. Definitely check it out. And
do you have any, like, before we move on? I mean, it's just the two of us. We're here. Just setting the scene.
Want to do some confessionals?
Do you have any other big plans for the season? Obviously, we've got Beyond Fest opening up this week.
This week is Beyond Fest,
which goes on for 2 weeks. And then we go, obviously, there's some travel. We're going to see Salem. I think that's going to be exciting, getting to see a place like that.
I've never been, so I'm really excited. I'm going to break out my trench coat. I'm hoping it's nice and cool there. So we're going to be there the weekend of, I guess it's the
9th, 10th.
9th, 10th, and 11th. Yeah, I think we fly out early on the 11th. And then our Tales from the Crypt live episode is that night.
Days later, we're in Knoxville.
Yeah, and then we fly out to Knoxville. What are the dates? That's the weekend of...
That's the following weekend. And that we're there for a good few days. So if you're anywhere near Tennessee... even if you are somewhere far away and want to come down, come on down. I think that's going to be a good
Chattanooga
time.
Crew. Come on down.
I think that's going to be fun. I think there's going to be a nice group of people just hanging out, watching cool movies and Girdlerthon.
Yeah, Girdlerthon. And then I am also, and right after our Knoxville trip, my fiance gets to town. So we're going to do a lot of cool Halloween horror stuff here at the very tail end. And I was really excited. I should mention the new Bev is doing a whole series of matinees all month long
I had no idea.
Are you being serious?
No, because I have to do the calendar in a couple of days.
so you must know.
Yeah, I'm looking at all these. No, it's a really I might know a few more that aren't on there yet, but there are. It's such a good horror calendar. It's crazy. Like, they've got matinees, they've got freakouts, they've got classics, they've got
But it seems to be mostly just matinees and during the day, because it's still Once Upon a Time in Hollywood in the evenings.
No, there's a lot of other things still.
There's going to be other things.
But maybe not horror. I think it's, I can't really say.
I guess the schedule is still working itself out as of right now.
And you can probably hear that in a week or so. But a lot of horror, and there will be an all-nighter. Phil has that on the books for the 19th. Unfortunately, me and you are going to
be out of town.
And I was really bummed about that, because I've been to that most years and I love it. But look out for tickets for that if you're in the area.
Hellraiser 3 Hell on Earth is playing October 18th. We're out of town.
That's my favorite. They're doing, what is it called? Franchise Freakout. And so it's like the one in a franchise that goes bonkers. I love that.
Every Friday. Yeah. And I already have tickets for Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein and the original Nightmare on Elm Street, which I've never seen a film print of. All over the years, I'd get like a freaking – I'd go to like a fandom event and it'd be a terrible-looking DVD.
Interesting,
So I'm very, very excited to see an actual film print of Nightmare on Elm Street.
It's one of the great horror films. I still maintain it should have been number one of that damn Screen Drafts pick. God damn. I still have flashbacks about that.
I couldn't even finish it because I was so infuriated by you people.
I don't blame you. It wasn't me. I did everything I could.
I think Ryan and I need to go on that show and really set the record straight.
Okay, you can.
Psycho's playing October 2nd. That's pretty cool. Just a lot of good stuff.
Yeah, no, it's a good calendar. There's a couple other all-nighters around here. There is also I think the Arrow has one too, which I'm not sure. I think they do announce what it is, but they haven't picked the titles yet.
Yeah, that's going to be, I think, the 26th or so, later in the month.
Yeah,
In October. We're not even done with September yet.
Yeah, no, it's going to be a crazy month, and obviously we'll be traveling a bit during it, so that some of the shows will be live shows and some will be banks. But don't worry, we got you. We're gonna be cranking through. We don't quit from during October.
Well, Elric and I don't.
That's right. Yeah, all the other quitters who aren't here.
All right, let's see if our guest is here, and you'll hear from our sponsors one more time. This episode is brought to you by the Nick Taylor Horror Show. Now, are you a horror director or an aspiring horror director? Would you like to get free filmmaking advice from some of the latest and greatest names in horror history? Well, you are in luck, because the Nick Taylor Horror Show podcast is your go-to masterclass in horror filmmaking. Featuring interviews with guests like Joe Dante, Mick Garris, Roger Corman, William Lustig, Bill Moseley, and Mitzi Peroni, each episode of Nick Taylor Horror Show explores and deconstructs the success strategies of established horror directors while summarizing the key insights and resources that you can use for your own filmmaking journey. This includes their creative process, strategies for getting the first films off the ground, favorite books and tools, key life lessons, and much, much more. Download and subscribe to the Nick Taylor Horror Show today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere you listen, or visit nicktaylor.com for more information.
Vinegar Syndrome October lineup has finally been unveiled. From the creator of Beyond the Door and The Visitor, aka the greatest holy fucking shit movie ever made, comes Beyond the Door 3, better known in some circles as Amok Train. This totally batshit crazy Euro gore fest features flesh melting, decapitation by train, impaling Bo Svensson, and a toothless witch. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. If low budget high sleaze 80s camping slashers are your thing, the never on disc sleeper Berserker should give you everything you crave and maybe more. Terrific. Plus, one of the great forgotten horror gems to emerge from England in the 80s and unofficially set in or inspired by the Friday the 13th universe, Unmasked Part 25, makes its disc debut in startling clarity. Yeah, that one looks pretty bonkers. Giving you a great opportunity to enjoy its plentiful drippy kills and heartfelt monologues. But being October, Vinegar Syndrome can't just bring you the usual tally of four films. So instead, to make this Halloween season extra special, brace yourself for the Amityville Cursed Collection box set, which brings together Amityville, The Evil Escapes, It's About Time, from Hellbound director Tony Randall, and It Is About Time, New Generation, and perhaps most notoriously, Dollhouse. Gosh, if that's notorious, I hate to think. All in brand new 4K restorations. This four-film collection, along with all other October releases, will only be available for purchase on VinegarSyndrome.com. And while you're on the site, be sure to sign up for the almost monthly newsletter to stay on top of exclusive deals, promotions, and other surprises. Make sure to come say hello at Cinema Wasteland, Monster Mania, Chiller, and other festivals near you.
Okay, and welcome back to the show. Elric and I are still here.
We are still here. We're not sick. We work for a living.
We do work for a living. And we're excited because we have not had this person on this iteration of the show. Last time we had Travis Stevens on was Killer POV 75.
Where you been?
Welcome back, Travis Stevens. How are you, man?
Thank you. I got locked out of the building.
So. Oh, okay.
It's good to finally be let back in.
Well, the first thing he said to us is video stores were going to come back, so I'm happy.
Yeah.
He's got a very optimistic approach.
It's true. I wake up every day just going, today is the impossible, and we're going to make it happen.
Yeah.
Well, let's just dive right in with the impossible, because last time we talked to you way back when, remember when you were a film producer? I know it's a long time ago. Were you pretty slow? Now, I mean, look, for people who don't know, I still maintain one of the greatest movies of the post-2000 movies, Cheap Thrills, would probably make a top 10 for me of favorite post-2000. I love that film. I love everything you guys put into it, but a lot of great films, a lot of horror films, a lot of, you know, Starry Eyes is another film. But, you know, you're known as an indie producer maverick, kind of carving out a niche of a kind of film, the Snowfort film, and we've talked about all of this at length on the other show. So making a segue to directing, I guess I just want to dive in with that in a sense, because I'm curious. I feel like to change it up, unless it was always a passion, there's a project that you're like chomping at the bit to do, or there's something you've been seeing in yourself that you realize I need to express, because you're not the only one. Another producer who I really respect and love did it this year too, being Ant Timpson. Yeah. I know a little bit about his story, about why he made that one, but I don't know much about what your, you know, jumping off or shift point for this particular film was.
And we're talking about Girl on the Third Floor, by the way, which is Travis's directorial debut
writing
for narrative.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah,
writing
yeah.
And directing.
Yeah, so this is your first feature. It's on the festival circuit now. It's coming out in October. But yeah, basically, as Elric said, I mean, you had your hand creatively on so many of the most interesting and unique genre movies that we've seen in the last couple of years. Well, why was this story the one that you had to tell yourself?
Well, I guess, and maybe just because I don't know any better, but I think producers are storytellers.
Yeah.
And it's just a different, you're just responsible for different aspects of the story. So creatively on all of the movies we've made, I've felt just as much an author of what's being created as the writer or the director. So this transition for me wasn't that big a transition because these are the same sort of conversations I'm having throughout the process on any movie. And then I think like the bottom line is, you know, as a producer, you're always sort of looking for the opportunities. Somebody wants a movie in X genre and somebody else wants an actor from blah, blah, blah. And you are looking to sort of bring those elements together. And on this, a financing company that we had worked with on Starry Eyes and We Are Still Here had a haunted house and they couldn't find a story for it. And we were going through the usual process of talking with writers and bringing directors in. And it was one of those things where just nobody was getting excited about any of the pitches. And I don't think it's because the pitches weren't good. I think just, I don't know. The haunted house was in the hometown of the financiers. And I think they had a lot of real hope for it. Mm. They wanted something really special.
When you say haunted house, because it's a great house, did they actually have a mythos around it? Or is it just,
Yeah. So they had purchased it and then found out, oh, you know, there's a local legend about this house. And so then for me, after bringing in so many writers and bringing in so many directors and it not going anywhere, I had sort of come up with a pitch and I was like, well, why don't I just write this? And if you don't like it, no problem. But if you do, great. And no matter what, it'll be a fun exercise for me. And I think, you know, back to your point about Ant Timpson or you know, Roxanne Benjamin or Jen Wexler, who had also gone through this. I think that we're in this sort of state right now of indie horror films where it's getting tougher and tougher to get stuff made. And at least for me, if you're going to put in all of that effort, maybe you want a little bit more of the reward from it. So that's a very long answer.
Why had you seen, but like watching other directors, I mean, obviously you're learning all the time. That's the other thing. You're doing your job, but you're also working with directors, seeing how they do their job. Did you ever, I guess it's like getting when you're bit with the itch. Did you ever have that? Because that sounds very organic the way you got the pitch. But before that, being on some of these sets, did you ever have the feeling like, oh, I'm really interested in constricting? Because it is different. I agree. Being a producer, it's completely an art form, but they are different art forms because, you know, setting up the camera, setting up a frame, that side of it is another skill. And I think that's actually done very competently in your film. That's what's interesting. It's like a really well-made movie. Did you have that feeling on any of the sets leading up to this?
I had that feeling on all of us.
Okay, good.
Yeah, so I think
I
that's
just
probably
make sure you have the same sickness we all have.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. No, I think I came out of college going, I'm going to make movies, and then it took a long time to figure out how to make movies, and then it took 10 years of working with other filmmakers to really build up the vocabulary to feel confident enough that now I can actually make movies. So I was blessed to work with a lot of filmmakers who in their career had it figured out already. Yeah. And so working with Evan Katz or Sarah Dina Smith or you know, any of the other, you know, Dennis and Kevin from Starry Eyes, it's like it was always learning. And then also it was super collaborative. Yeah. So I didn't feel like I was spending 10 years in a trailer just writing checks, you know. So
yeah. Even though you did write me a check once for my 4-year-old kid. I remember it was a $50 check.
Is this
he had a little screen. He had to put on a prosthetic. It was pretty cool. It was Karen. Yeah. He's technically Rosemary's baby, I think. In a flashback
right.
or something.
That is right.
He wasn't very directable, though, from memory.
Yeah, I blame Karen Kusama. Yeah,
she was very good. I was impressed with her direction, but I think it was just,
That's XX we're talking about.
Good luck directing 4-year-olds, is all I can say. And I remember Trent Haga was in the back, and he had his kid there as the back backup. And he was terrified because he's like, oh, my kid's even worse. But that's just part of the job.
Yeah.
One thing I was really curious to ask before getting into the grits on this particular film was just in that 10 years, let's just think about that 10 years. How have you seen and also seeing it now from the inside and also from the directing perspective, how have you seen the indie horror industry, this change, you know, and the way festivals are and the way financing, what are some of the major shifts you're seeing occur? Because I think a lot of people listening are in that position, myself included, where you're like, okay, what's the best way? Is it to do small donors and figure out a small, like what Jill Six is, you know, probably a day away from hopefully making her target, right? But even when you get that amount of money, how do you get this thing done?
Yeah.
How much has that changed? Because you made it sound like it's getting harder.
Yeah. And of course, I'll preface this with everything I say is from my limited experience or perspective. And I am introduced to people all the time who are like, yeah, we're making our first film for $2 million.
Yeah.
You know, my experience is like right now, you need to make the movie for whatever you can scrape together from whoever you can scrape it together and make it, scale it to the money you have, come up with a story that works for that amount of money that you can pull off really competently. And then your second one might get easier.
Yeah.
But whether it's Jill's, like I was so excited about Jill's because I had had an experience or an opportunity to sort of maybe be involved in another movie that they were looking to put together, and watching how much effort her team put in to get a modest budget, and just they keep hitting a ceiling and hitting a ceiling where it's somebody else being like, you know what, maybe I don't believe in this. Mm. And you're like, well, fuck, man, I'm like 6 months into this with you, this conversation, and you're going to leave me hanging here. And it's like, so for her to be like, hey, you know what, I'm doing it. I'm doing it for what I know I can do it for. And like, it's great. And I've been having that conversation a lot with filmmakers who are like, yeah, we're thinking low budget. We're thinking maybe $500,000. And I would say currently that is big budget for the indie horror space. And
yeah. Like 200, 150 is probably lower.
Yeah.
But even 100 if it's your first thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the economics come down to how much is the end user going to pay? And how many end users are there, and how much revenue is coming back to the company that's going to distribute it. And then they do their calculations on how much they anticipate that and how much it's going to cost to put it out. And blah, 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 blah. All that comes back to how much they're willing to pay.
And that's the number that's been going down, right? Like what people are actually buying independent.
So like you guys last week, we're talking about all the streaming services and we can watch this over here and we can watch this over there, da, 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 and the cost is very low.
Yeah, that doesn't add up the same as if we're able to sell whatever it is, 100,000 Blu-rays or DVDs across the country, as opposed to just paying one low price for a streaming service.
And no Walmart and things like IFC Midnight that I know was a big one for a long time. It's still around and still doing the game, but it seems like what they can pay for that. I mean, you were in that position.
I'm still in it. But the last couple of years have been really fascinating because I feel like, I do want to go back to the beginning a little bit at some point because I feel like even just 10 years ago, it was such a different world. Yeah, whereas now it's like, people have to understand, it's like, all right, you made a movie for X amount. And now it's like, can you get it into Walmart? Walmart is the biggest chain in the country. For the most part, you can't. And if you're lucky enough to get it there, depending on what kind of movie you are, you may get one weekend where it's on a shelf. And if people don't buy it after that, those 100,000 discs come back to whoever made them and you just eat that cost. Yeah. Like you're not just because Walmart takes all those discs doesn't mean that you're going to sell them all. It's
then you're still going to pay for them.
Again, it's like one of the other things also is how much the foreign market has changed because I learn a lot of this through my fiance because she lives in Paris and I want to know how she can't get a lot of the movies we talk about on the show. And a big part of it from my perspective doing distribution was, a territory like Paris, right? They'll only pay, I don't know, $2,000 to license a movie there, but it's probably going to cost more than that just to get subtitles and to actually physically deliver it. And so at that point, you're like, well, why bother? Like, we're literally going to lose money trying to put it out in a territory like Paris and add that up with 10 other territories over there. And how do you make money now? Like, that's been the big challenge and shift is how are we going to, you know, make our budget back.
Yeah. And it all makes sense. It's like, I think everybody has the best intentions and everybody want, whether you're a distributor or sales agent or theatrical booker or whatever, but we're all like going down the drain together, where it's like, oh, we got to lower the budget so we can make more money. No, now the movie, the quality of the movie is going to be lower, which is going to make somebody want to spend less on marketing and you know, putting the muscle behind it to give it a proper release. So on the one hand, it's like, great, we have, you know, streaming services that you could theoretically put any movie out onto and a lot of people could see it. But the economics of that are basically you're giving the movie away, and unless something miraculous happens where, you know, whatever the number is, 10 million people decide to watch it on Amazon Prime for free, you're not going to see any revenue from that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's basically what's changed over the last 10 years is when the sort of modern horror resurgence started happening, there were traditional distributors, there were traditional retailers. Streaming was at the beginning of its life. So there was still revenue out there for a really robust ecosystem. And the genre film festival circuit came up. So that sort of served as like a grassroots theatrical run for a lot of these films. A lot of press would be invited down because the festivals had good sponsorships so they could bring in press. And all of a sudden you were sort of emulating a traditional indie film release for genre films. Mm. Obviously, film criticism and film journalism, you know, has its revenue cut. Film festivals have its sponsorships cut. Distributors start going out of business, blah, blah, blah. We're just left with very little.
We're left with Twitter.
Yeah, exactly.
You're reduced to everyone's opinion on Twitter. Yeah.
And that's why, sorry, Ian, you were talking about, you know, Shudder Live TV and I think last week, and I think one of the things that I love about Joe Bob's show on there is that sense of connection.
It's an event.
That we're having again. So even though the financials are really tough, there are sort of new things that are coming up that at least are hopefully going to somehow revitalize this or keep it going.
I mean, the festival circuit does seem to be – it does create a fear of missing out. And everyone – it seems exciting. Yeah. These pockets that pop up, even when you can't get to it, I get excited. Yeah. And I think there – I would be curious, like in terms of marketing, like to me, if something goes straight to VOD – I find myself, even if it's a great cover, I find myself really uninterested. I don't know why. I don't want to spend money. But if that same thing played at a festival that I can't go to, and now I'm excited for a couple of months about it, and then finally it comes out on VOD, I'm buying it the second it hits.
What do you think that is? You think it's just a word of mouth? I think it's somebody that you trust saying, hey, I heard this is good.
I think it feels like their quality has been vetted because some festival and some people have said, this was interesting, we want to see it. Even though the one that went straight to VOD probably didn't even bother going that route, right? Yeah. They might have just had a deal where they had to go straight to VOD. It just feels different. It may be just this generation and this, like you're talking about, this new horror wave, in a sense, not death wave, that pops up. I've got you on here. Should we get? No, we're not going to get it. You know, how it's going to be marketed. It might just, it's the only way this you can really get the word out.
Yeah. I mean, my perspective on it is when I'm 47, I think. When
I love that you ended with
you would see an ad in the back of a magazine or a comic book for a movie that was coming 3 months down the road, or you would see a poster at your theater.
Yeah.
Oh, next month. When's it going to come? When is Megaforce going to come out? What is Megaforce? I need to know.
Yeah.
And maybe this is sort of the modern equivalent of that, where there's not a lot of marketing materials out there. Maybe you get a trailer or teaser or some stills, but that word of mouth that starts coming out on Twitter or some of the reviews sort of builds that sense of anticipation and gives the movie value that you might not feel if it's just suddenly available there. And I think part of my issue with Netflix is, great, we've got a new movie from the guy who did, you know, Moon, or a new movie from the guy who did you know, Ex Machina. And then here it is.
Yeah.
But there's been none of that sort of build up to takeoff.
Yeah.
So it's just there. And how am I supposed to have an emotional connection to it? Because you haven't flirted with me. You haven't, you know.
Often they don't even say, here it is. Often you just go through and go, oh, there it is. You're like, I didn't even know they had done that.
I was talking about this earlier today. Maybe even on the show. I can't remember. But literally it's like Netflix now is – I can't find a single old movie or something that's not a Netflix original on Netflix anymore. Like you literally put up.
It's hard.
It's all whatever they've created for you, and it's all within the last couple of years. And it's so overwhelming because there's seasons of shows that I liked that I haven't even gotten to yet. And so it's really – that's overwhelming. But you know, back to the Shudder thing, it's like, I do think that we need to be creative and everything feels cyclical. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, I forgot how much I missed just turning on the TV and seeing that Slumber Party Massacre 2 was on. Yeah. I was like, oh, great. I've watched that movie twice this week.
Yeah, yeah.
In what world would I go out of my way to watch Slumber Party Massacre 2 that's twice? Great. It just happened to be on. And again, it's the same thing with, you know, I always hope that physical media will come back, but the thing with Fangoria coming back the way it did. I think it needed to go away the way it did because it was kind of the top of the, you know, like the just web presence. Everybody had a website. Everyone's doing scoops and all that. It went away for a little bit, and now you could only get it as I refer to it. It's like the vinyl. It's like everyone wants to get that record again. Now, like Fangoria is just that print thing.
And I think this is when I use that phrase, we're all sort of like chasing each other down the drain. Mm. Like that's what I mean. The opposite is saying no. I'm going to create something of value. Mm-hmm. I'm going to hire the best people to create the best quality version of that thing I can do, and I'm going to charge a premium for it. Mm.
And you're going to buy it because if you don't, you're missing out on quality shit.
Exactly.
Because we had Paul Thomas Anderson talking to Jordan Peele. I'm like, I'm not lying. That's the reason I did it. I would have supported Fango anyway, probably. Yep. But when I heard it was that, I was like, I got to read that.
And I think, you know, what Phil and Meredith have done with the magazine and sort of what Waxworks Records did and Death Waltz, it's like, it's the same sort of idea, which they're helped by a nostalgia for classic horror titles a little bit. But I think it will translate to new films as well. And so I do think there will be a new model moving forward where you could make movies and pay your rent making movies. It's just right now we're at the tail end of this sort of bad version of the business.
Figuring it out.
I'd love to – we talk about crowdfunding. I would love to see one where it's just like all you're paying is for the ticket. And the person gets all the ticket sales in advance, and then they make the movie with that money. Like, it's as simple as that. There's no other money to be spent.
And I don't know if this is true or not, but you know, maybe movie making is a flawed business model anyways, because if that were just the business model, then tons of movies would never get made because so many movies cost way too much and never make their money back.
All the stuff we love, all the crazy shit.
But at the end of the day, I mean, I was thinking there might be sort of, you look at what the music business did, where it's like bands are going to make their money off the merch and they're going to make their money off their one-on-one sort of premium experiences. And I think there's a movie version of that where whether, you know, like Darren Bousman was traveling with his film or I think Adam Green might've done it.
Adam did it with The Last Hatchet.
It's like that idea of if you have enough of a fan base, not even millions and millions and millions, but just enough that you can go and they'll be willing to pay a little bit extra for that actual engagement with the artists and then become more of a patron of the arts versus just a consumer.
Mm-hmm.
So
almost like a movie pass, but for getting indie stuff made. Like you pay your monthly subscription fee and stuff's getting made.
Are we creating something right now?
We could be. And we are TMing the shit out of it right now as we took a trip.
That's right.
I think new ways have to be found because otherwise, like you say, it probably will start to be impossible, but it's not impossible. There's always this. I mean, it is funny because in the 80s, you know, and with the Sam Raimis of the world, they did have the tax write-off, right? Like the dentist, and that just doesn't exist in the same way, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's still tax credits and they still make a huge difference. It's just all the other numbers don't make sense.
Yeah, I got you. Yeah.
So,
we're all the dentists to back us up there.
Yeah, everybody got smart.
That used to be, that's true.
Well, I'm not producing that. So to tie it back to your new movie, the one that you made, but also like kind of really early on, I don't know, I just think this would be fascinating. Early on, one of your earliest movies is A Horrible Way to Die, which is Adam Wingard, who's making freaking King Kong versus Godzilla right now. Simon Wingard, AJ Bowen, Amy Simons, who's gone on to do much tremendous stuff. Could you make A Horrible Way to Die now as the way you made it back then?
Yeah.
No, oh, okay.
Yeah, it's exact simple same stuff. I mean,
so basically the approach hasn't changed really since you started making movies.
No. I think the end result, the quality depends on some variables that are outside of our control or outside of my control, but no, you could, $50,000, $100,000, you can go and make something great. You just have to make a movie that you can pull off for that money.
Yeah.
Or it needs to be a little bit bigger, but not complete, you know, not out of reach. So A Horrible Way to Die, you know, oh, there's a scene where the cops pull him over and there's an escape from jail. And there, you know, on the script, there were some big stuff, but it was sort of scaled to, well, it's achievable if you start getting impressionistic with it. So, yeah, I think anybody can make a movie for any amount of money that is compelling. It just needs to be the right story for that budget. Yeah, and so, you know, speaking about Adam Wingard and any of the other guys, I just have a wall in my house that has their pictures on it, and every day I just look at it, and I'll be like, one day I'm going to catch up to you guys.
Well, you started pretty strong here, so let's get into it. I mean, because this ticks a lot of my sweet spots. You have you go deep on practical effects. You have you're exploring misogyny. You're exploring relationships, marriage, like all the shit that all the was something I'm always missing in horror films, and something that I kind of vow myself to always hold myself to if I get to make something is adult driven horror and not fear. It's something that I think's been bled out of our genres, sexuality and sex, which not to say they need to be sex movies, but it's a huge part of our human behavior. And I feel like in the last 10 years, I was just watching some Tales from Crypt before I get here. I forgot how fucking crazy they were. Everyone's fucking and talking about sex. And I'm like, this is a part, and our psychology is part of who we are. And yet movies now are getting so neutered. And what they're losing a danger element, and this film's really diving into being about sex and what a person needs to keep going, what they think they deserve. There's a great line early on that threw me, because you've got a character who is a challenging character, because like the first few minutes I like this guy, that's good, and then you give us different layers of this character and you make him more complicated. And I don't think I don't feel like you're being too judgy, which is nice. Even if you might feel like, oh yeah, morally this guy's going in a certain direction, I don't feel like you're sitting there judging him. You're letting people make up their own mind, you know. Yeah. And the house will make up its mind, which is the fun part, right? So I again, it's probably not a question. let's start just with your haunted house pitch gets picked, and then where do you start getting the gig as the director, right? Like, and when do you start? And the other thing I know we were really interested in is then with casting. Does the casting of somebody like CM Punk, who I didn't know before, I know a lot of people obviously do, does that help get this made in a different way?
Yeah, I think in this particular case, it's not like a small snowball that rolls down a hill and picks up and gets bigger and bigger. Yeah. It's like the financiers own the house, so they were already incentivized. They just needed a story.
Yeah.
Oh, we got a story. We just need a director. So it was like I sort of saw that all of the lights, like on a road, the traffic lights were lined up, and if I just hit that first one, we'd be fine. I think like on this one, it's sort of like I knew what the budget was going to be because I knew what they would be comfortable to spend, and it's low. And so you go, all right, how do you do a genre that we've seen so much of, and that the recent examples, say the Conjuring series or something, it's like they're doing it so much better on a technical level because they can literally sculpt whatever experience they want in a scene by having walls fly out and cameras do whatever. So what are the elements you can do for no money that will still have some cinematic value to it? And so on one hand, it's practical effects. Like, yeah, let's bring in as much wetness and goo as we can fit into it. The first thing, though, that even at the pitch for me was that sort of idea of an adult movie where it's like, I think when you're operating on that big studio horror movie level, you're just trying to just appeal to the most number of people possible. And when you're a small movie, it's like punk rock. It's like you got to play loud and fast and just get people's attention. So for me, the actual haunted house is actually across the street from a church. And I was like, that's what makes this particular location unique. Mm. And that story of, you know, do I give in to my vice or do I, you know, choose a different path was like the starting point for it. So it sort of informed everything before anything's even written. Those sort of like aspects of knowing what this budget is, knowing where we're going to shoot, sort of informed all of the actual creative stuff. Mm. If that makes sense.
And then what about the themes? Like, because like I said, it's not just about sex. It feels very modern. It feels like a film about right now in a lot of ways, because it's about characters who could be good. Like I watch something like that. It's very easy to get to the end of something, yeah, that judge somebody. But like as I'm watching, I'm like, oh yeah, no, I understand this person. Yeah. And then something can happen that can change how you view that person. But like we talk about all the time, but just canceling a person is short fucking vision for change and, you know, hope of a better future, you know? And it feels like that's a huge theme, I think, to what you're trying to craft.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I think as an artist, you sort of are looking at what the world is around you, and you're also sort of looking at what your own experience is. And certainly, you know, I'm 47, and the growth I've had as an individual over the last 10 years is huge.
Yeah.
And I look at some of my own behavior when I was younger and I find it reprehensible. I do think every single person has the capacity to change and do the right thing. And it's just a matter of them deciding to. And so with this particular movie, I wanted to sort of explore that you can give in to your lesser self or not. And so that's why the sort of religious figure in this movie doesn't come in and save the day. She's there to just sort of say, here's what's going on, and my door is always open, right across the street. If you get tired of hanging out with sexy ghosts, come talk to me.
Which is an impossible choice. I mean, you put two sexy ghosts, it's impossible.
For some, you know, for someone else, no.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was a lot of sort of like, you know, that's the heart of the movie, and that's what I want to explore. And I really appreciate you pointing that out, because I had read a review that had so misread the film that when I did my director's commentary, I think I condemned the protagonist of the film a bit more severely.
Yeah.
just make it clear like where my point of view is. But so it's really nice to hear that, because that is the point, which is Don is
who literally, by the way, when you called him Don, I just need to tell you, because I thought it was funny. My first impression, because I did not know CM Punk. He walks in and it's like Roddy Piper. He's a good actor. Like, he actually can act, which is always, you know, from wrestling. Entrance instantly said, it's Don Draper and Henry Rollins.
Oh, yeah.
So the fact that his name was Don, didn't every time I kept thinking about him in that way, it really looks like that.
Yeah.
It is good.
Yeah. So we know the budget level that we're at, and you're working through your cast list. And you know, there's people that you know you can work with, or you've worked with, that you had a great experience with. And on the financial side, what can we do that'll help sort of raise this movie's profile? And Phil Brooks, aka CM Punk, is a Chicago native, and my fellow producer Greg Newman had been like, well, you know, Bobcat Goldthwait recommended him for this Billy Jack type movie he wanted to do. Maybe we should talk to him. And I was like, oh, yeah, okay. I mean, not the character I had in my head, but that doesn't mean we can't rethink the character. And what I love about Phil is, whether in wrestling or mixed martial arts and now acting, he just comes at it with like this blue collar work ethic. And I'll say no ego. I mean, maybe he wouldn't say that. But for me, dealing with talent, it was just a person who was just there and was so excited and so happy and just wanted to put in work and do good work and make something awesome. So in talking with him, it was effortless. It was like, yeah, sure, cool, we'll do it. It's your first movie. It's my first movie. As long as we can talk like this throughout the process, we'll be fine. So that sort of tailoring the look, you know, there were different versions. There was the skinny sort of Jared Kushner version of the character. And then there was the more burlier, you know, AJ Bowen version of the character. And then we ended up with a sort of a David Beckham version of the character. You know, somebody that got the tattoos because tattoos were cool. And
did you do any rewriting once you knew who would play it? Did like that? And did that affect?
It was more about how he carries himself. Mm. And I think even just as a director, it's like, okay, you know, this person's covered in tattoos, so I don't want him to come in looking like a, you know, like a musician or you know, like a lumberjack or something. So trying to think of who this character was before he walked into the house that justifies how he looks right now, that was part of it. And so sort of tweaking his backstory and then changing basically the conversations he's having with people. So the character, same idea, no matter who plays him, but tailored specifically for Phil.
Yeah. And he's a guy you would like if you met him on the street without knowing everything about his behavior, the behavior he keeps secret might change your opinion, but anything you saw of a character like this on the public surface, you would enjoy being around him, whether you're a man or a woman. And that's made very clear in the first
act. I think the same thing with the house.
Yeah.
It's like the whole movie is about just looks being deceiving, mm-hmm. and what something's true nature is will reveal itself eventually. Yeah.
What was I'd be curious what the mythology, even if it's just brief, of the house was, but and I don't know how much we even want to say like now in terms of, you know, when we get plot information in the film, like what the house was before. I don't know if that's something that's out there on public, so I want to be careful not to give too much away, but it's really interesting because it is tied directly to kind of the theme.
Yeah, I mean,
you know better than me. I don't know the marketing of
that. Yeah, I mean, I think it's all out there. The actual house we shot in was reportedly a bordello back at the turn of the century. And there were two women that died there. One was a child and was left sort of wrapped up in tarps near the train tracks. And then another one was supposedly a sex worker who was there. So, again, for me, at that starting point, it's like if you're going to film a movie in an actual haunted house, you should try to sort of honor the trauma that took place there instead of just writing something arbitrary. So knowing that, I wanted to try to incorporate at least the spirit of the real girl's experience into this helped sort of say, okay, what is this movie going to be about versus just random ghosts or tons of ghosts or whatever. So then it becomes a story a bit about sex, incorporate sex much more to both honor the past and sort of explore some of the aspects of weakness.
Right. And sex is, I guess, isn't even quite right for that. And it tends to be how men use women or throughout the ages, right? Because you are charting a time period and there's this like weighing a judgment being made throughout the house is making a judgment on it. You've still got a choice. You're still free to choose, but there's going to be a judgment on the character, which I think is an interesting build. And that feels pretty original. I don't think I've seen that in a, you know, that clear a path in a haunted house film before, really.
I mean, to me, it did. Yeah. But then, you know, somebody will always point out a movie. Like, I hadn't seen Deep Red. I didn't see Deep Red. Somebody was like, oh, loved your film, man. I loved your film. All the Deep Red references. I was like, I haven't seen that. And then you go, oh, well, yeah, no, I guess it's out there. But yeah, to me, it did, you know, because we've seen this sort of, oh, the house corrupts someone story before. And I was like, what if it doesn't? Just sort of reveals them.
Yeah.
And I think narratively, the handoff that happens in this story in the third act allows us to do something we haven't seen before, which is a reset.
Yeah. I won't spoil that, but it does change your whole perspective of what you've been seeing. Let's talk a bit about the effects, because I think there is a misnomer that a lot of people really go to, you know, visual effects versus practical. Obviously, they too can, you know, speak to each other, but practical can actually be cheaper and it can be more effective because you can get it in the shot. Yeah, talk, because this was your first time working with them as a director. I'm curious what you're, because there's a lot. I mean, there's, you have a lot of ooze, you have a lot of goo, and it's, and it adds, to me, it adds it's kind of like great production value. It's like the house itself. It's adding a huge amount of production value.
Yeah, totally. And for me, it's sort of like I had made enough movies where I'm experienced enough with practical effects. I have a sense of the timing and the requirements for them. So I wrote gags in this movie that I thought we could pull off at this budget level. So that, like, for example, the house pretty much looks exactly as it looks in the movie, minus the mirrors. All of our production design budget was spent on building fake walls and wall interiors and fake sinks and stuff so we could do these practical effects stuff. Like, that's, if you know, if you've done it a few times, you can sort of design it. You can engineer it in such a way. And while everybody worked really hard, I believe the special effects team and the art team felt that it was reasonable requests, not too insane. So,
it's funny because having followed, you know, we've all known each other for a long time, but having followed you on Instagram for years, the thing I've always found, you know, most interesting is the references to art throughout. And it's often stuff of similar taste. Like I'll see something, go, oh, I love that piece. This is where I saw it all. It was kind of funny. It felt like I saw the cumulative effect of a lot of the things, whether they're some of the person who, I think the woman maybe in LA does kind of body stuff. I saw pieces of that. I saw other the things on the mirror that felt kind of Cronenbergian and kind of light, but I just started seeing the tactile nature of what your influence and inspirations had been, almost like a visual diary that you'd been keeping over years, which is inspiring.
And I think around the same time that I started feeling a bit constrained by just producing, and it was sort of like the opportunities, it was just getting more and more challenging to do original stuff. And it seemed like, okay, it's going to be easier if you go and do something generic. So around while that was happening, which was a bit stifling, I started exploring Instagram a lot more as sort of a gateway to other artists to just sort of reignite my own sort of connection to what it is we're supposed to be doing, which is making art. And so while I might be working on something that I was like, oh man, I was like, oh, but look at this sculptor, Sarah Sicken. Yeah. Oh my God, she's got a show happening this week. I'll go check it out. Or look at this painter and blah, blah, blah. And Instagram was so good at sort of, you know, highlighting so much contemporary art that's happening around the world that's been influenced by horror films, but it's totally fresh and coming at it from a new perspective. Because that was another thing I had sort of felt was like in the horror genre, we're like cannibalizing ourselves so much that everything is fucking fifth generations of the same ideas. Yeah. And to just see somebody who's operating outside of that space was really invigorating. And that's sort of what my, yeah, my Instagram feed became, which is just a daily sort of thing for myself to just remember like, no, there's this out there. And you know, I still paint and I find directors who paint and directors who are sort of looking towards books and looking to music for inspiration tend to create something a little bit more original. Yeah. So I wrote down some of the Instagram artists.
Perfect. Also, because whoever did your poster, that also was something I recognized. And what I loved is one of the creatures, I'll say, in your film, it felt the same. Like, I felt like whoever did the poster really captured the essence and the surrealist kind of bent that you went for.
Yeah, and the, I'd say the creature design was partially influenced by his work, Serge Sarum.
Yeah,
Serge Sarum. I mean, it's a
different poster than the one he's looking at. He's looking at the red one, but kind of painted, hand painted pink and kind of.
And to me, it seemed like a nice way to. He did the festival poster.
Oh, wow.
It seemed like a nice way to honor. So his work as a painter inspired my work as a filmmaker.
That's cool.
So why not hire him directly to do a painting for the film? So it really worked. But yeah, I mean,
is it cost effective? That's what everyone needs.
Everything. Yeah, I mean, it's all the same. Nobody gets paid anymore.
Yeah.
Just kidding. Yeah. Everybody gets paid. So Sarah Sicken's this fantastic sculptor who's working right now. Adriana Varejao, Varejao, another incredible person. And David Altmajid, Altmejd, it's another sculptor. And then my goal, I was like, this is my first film. I just want to make sure every frame could be stopped and it would be a work of art. It would have something of aesthetic value to it. And so I just sort of super looked to like a lot of painters and photographers for sort of palette inspiration and composition inspiration.
Had you worked with your DP before?
No.
On any of the other films?
No. The special effects guy, Dan Martin, who does all of Ben Wheatley's stuff and did Lords of Chaos and just did Richard Stanley's new movie. He came in from London. And then the production designers, Courtney and Hillary Anduar, came in from LA. And everybody else was a Chicago local. So, you know, it was very blessed to, I mean, because Chicago's got a lot of talented people who work on TV. So there's people with chops. There's not a lot of movies being shot there. So.
And you got a guy lived in Chicago for a while, and the one thing about the music scene.
I was going to ask about music.
Well, the one name of the music producers that I remember coming up all the time is doing your score.
Yeah.
Talk about that because it's a great score, and so and that adds again. You're talking about production value. You add another level of meaning.
He always sets something up and never says who it is
Are
you referring to Steve Albini?
Yeah, Albini, yes.
Thank you. Steve Albini. That's exciting. Yeah. Let's, you know.
No, I forgot his name. You outed me on forgetting his name in the middle.
He's another just a real down-to-earth guy. And I think, I don't know, at least in my experience, if you approach somebody reasonably and say, here's what I'm trying to do and here's why I'm interested in you doing it and why I think we'll make something cool together – it seems to work out.
Yeah.
And I still geek out. I have his like phone number in my phone. Like, I text Steve. I was like, oh my God, Steve Albini replied to my text.
That's cool. Yeah.
So I don't know. and maybe it's like this for other directors, there's still, I haven't separated enough from making this film yet to really appreciate how amazing it is that all of these people worked on it. Like, I'm still kind of making the film in my head, and even talking about it is sort of refining my connection to it. So I feel really blessed, and both with the cast and the crew and you know, guys like Steve and Dan and everybody. I feel very fortunate to be here with a mic in front of me talking about it.
But Steve's not necessarily and I don't know exact, because there's a couple of people listed in the music by.
Yeah, so he's just a giving guy. I mean, I was like, I reached out to him about being the composer, and he said, sure, I want to bring in my friend Allison, who's a sort of a classically trained violinist and cellist. And I'm thinking this guy, Tim Mignette, who was in this other band to do some guitars on it. Great. I mean, some other composer might have been like, no, those are the musicians to play my stuff. But I think they wrote the music together and just sort of sketched it out. And I gave my notes and they reformed it. And he's just a very – it's very funny. He's the easiest guy to do a deal with, and also really funny because he's like, yeah, I won't sign anything. So you can do the deal, awesome. But then it gets to a point where somebody else's head explodes because they're like, well, how do we know? And it's like, you just got to know.
It's like, as punk rock as it gets. Yeah, but exactly. He's never really done a traditional movie score though, right?
No, and it's and so when I reached out,
did it feel like left field when you called him?
No, no. Well, maybe. I would have to ask him. My sense was there had been so many musicians moving into composing that I thought, you know, whether it's economics or just creatively something new, it was like, I've seen it enough. I mean, we've worked with composers. Craig from Shudder to Think did Karin Kusama's section of XX, and I'm spacing another guy. We worked with another great musician, rock musician on a score. On another movie.
Happens to us all the time. Yeah, totally. That's
come on, Rob, save me.
Yeah. I got the IMDb here. Which one is it? Let's see. Shit.
Well, anyway, so it happened before and it worked on this. But what was interesting is, this is such a long-winded answer, but writing this and was a challenge because there's what I'm trying to say as an artist, and there's other people's expectations of what a haunted house movie should be. And I was really struggling with that dynamic for the first time because as a producer, you're normally outside of that. You're the mediator between the people. So you're not quite as emotionally invested in every single word. You're like, just change it.
Right? Yeah.
The guy falls in love with a car. I don't see what the problem is. And this time I was like really having a problem with it. And I kept thinking back to a friend of mine that I was in a band with named Aaron Baker, who passed away about 10 years ago. And he suddenly came into my head. And I remember in this band how unrelenting he was in whatever the thing was. Mm-hmm. Like, no, this is my vision. Fuck you. And I was just like, oh, man, that was really annoying to deal with all the time. But he was true, man. He was a true artist. Like, just – and it was so inspiring. And I was just thinking about that. And I'm like, oh, I feel better. And I was like, yeah, man. I remember when he used to play Big Black and we'd be on the road. I was like, yeah, Big Black. I should listen to some Big Black. Listen to Big Black. And the line, you know, from Bad Penny comes on, you know, should have known what a liar I am. Mm. Couldn't trust me by now. And I was like, that's this movie. Yeah. And so all of a sudden, I was like, that's the key to the main character in this movie. It's like, oh, you should have known I was a liar. It's your fault. Yeah. And I was like, oh, that's so great. It's so great. I'll just put it as the end credit song, just to honor that, to honor my friend who passed away, who like really inspired me in the moment. And, you know, when I was coming up as an artist, and then as more time went on, I was like, I mean, I could probably find his email and just reach out to Steve Albini and see if I could license that song. I mean, nobody's going to, what it's going to be like 10 grand. Like it'd be worth it. Yeah. Worth it. And then this fantasy just built in my head where I was like, yeah, I'm going to reach out and Steve's going to do the score. And then I wrote this long letter explaining what I was looking for and why I thought it would be perfect. And he was like, yeah, let's talk. And I was like, oh my God. the beginning of my point was when I reached out to Steve Albini, I was like, look, the score I'm looking for is not total like Mertzbau, like noise, abstract noise, but pretty close. He's like, no problem. And the score that's in the movie that they came back with is this like gorgeous string-based, very epic, almost proposition style, yeah, yeah. discordant, melodic stuff. Yeah. So anyways.
No, thank you. I love that whole story. That's what I love hearing that kind of stuff. You know, something that meant – that reminded you of another portion of your life and a friend that led to you listening yeah. to Big Black to like, maybe that dude – maybe that'll be the end song. Maybe that guy can do the score.
Yeah, and I think
– I love that.
And I don't know if everybody else's process is like that, but it's like everything in a movie that I make, I want to have that connection with. Like, I don't ever want to just do something because, oh, and then this thing needs to happen. Like, why is it happening? Why are you making this? Like, it's a work of art. It should be expressing something, or you should have some emotional connection to the thing you're making. And I think the mechanics of the film, you know, I'll only get better and better, but I know that every single idea in there is something I feel really passionately about, and I'm super proud of for that.
So yeah, I heard Sam Fuller had a quote that I just always use to tell students. It's not that you're wrong if you make something that's not emotional, but you have to know what it's going to connect to. And so he said something like, if you make a film from your brain, it's going to connect to their brain. If you make it from your heart, it connects to heart. If you make it from the testicles or the yeah. balls, it's going to hit them in the balls. Yeah. And it's like, you need to know what that is. And it's the problem with, I think, authenticity is often where somebody thinks they're making it with the heart, but it's really the head. And then it comes off cold and it hits you in that place where you're like, I don't quite believe this. And that happens a lot. But if you can strip it back to that truism, I think you can hit the right audience, you know? Yeah. And I think that's the best, especially with horror, because horror is so much about trauma that I like what you're saying, that you're honoring. You're not making a film. You weren't making a biopic of the ghost who died in the house, but you were honoring the fact that that really happened that to somebody.
Yeah. And on a pragmatic level, I think you have to. Like when I arrived on set for pre-production, I walked across the street and I was like, I'm going to tell this house what's up. And I walked into that house by myself at midnight because I'd come in. I think I landed at like 10:30. Walk into the house at midnight by myself and immediately felt pushed back. Like just the sense of dread. And I was like, oh, I'm like, whatever this house's deal is like legit. Like I'm feeling it right now. And you can't just come in and be like, I'm going to do whatever I want, exploit this place. And like, so that night I just had a series of sort of dialogues with the house, just walking from room to room saying, look, I'm going to do my best to honor what happened here. And we're going to tell our own story, but blah, 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 blah. And I felt better about that. And whether or not the house did, it seemed like the house did, but even if it was just my own interpretation, at least I was able to get through the next, you know, 6 weeks feeling more comfortable with what we were doing. And I think, you know, back to how it's reflected in the story is, like, there's nothing wrong with sex. There's nothing wrong with desire. There's nothing wrong with sex work. It's what how we act on our desires and whether or not we're being harmful in those. That I think that's the sort of point of the film. And I feel, without it being a biopic, I feel like with as little details as we have about what actually happened at that house, I feel like we've honored that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I see that for sure. I think that's the best you can do. You know, is hit it. Did your beliefs change at all? Because I mean, I remember we've talked to Ty West a long time ago about obviously shooting in, well, the house that they were, the hotel they were in for Devils obviously had a presence or a feeling, right? And my mom always tells me a story when I was growing up about, and she's not a believer, but an apartment they just walked into once, like looking to buy an apartment in France or somewhere, and you know, a similar feeling to what you had, an utter repellent, like you wanted to leave. And then they asked and they found out that the person who had been there right before had murdered somebody and jumped off the balcony and committed suicide. And when you feel it before you get that information, I find that to be fascinating. I lived in Savannah for a long time, felt it there. New Orleans, you feel it a little. Whether you believe or not, I don't know. Yeah. There's just something that almost a residue to things world. You know?
I don't know. Maybe I'm a hippie now, but like, you can walk down the street and feel an energy from somebody like, oh, that person's like really amped up right now or whatever. And it's like, of course, this whole cosmos is made out of energy from the past and the present. Yeah. I'm I'm not the type of person who's like going on ghost haunts or anything like that. But when you, because we had it on We Are Still Here, where Ted and I were in the basement and just in a corner by ourselves and just felt it. And we were like, there is 100% some presence right behind us. We didn't say anything. We just looked at each other. And then Ted just left me hanging and walked away. Son of a bitch. So then I'm like, it's cool. It's cool. But yeah, I mean, I think when you experience it, you that's what happens. And you go, oh, okay, this thing is legit. And in this house, enough small things were happening to different crew members throughout the course where everybody had their own connection to it. And I don't think that means like a place is necessarily ratcheted up to 11 the entire time. You know, because it seemed like our house would be chill sometimes. And then if somebody was there late at night, they'd get messed with a little bit. But that sense of dread that first night I walked in, I mean, it was as if somebody turned a switch off inside me where I literally walked in. I had a beer, I had a cigarette. I was like, I'm going to go in. I'm going to look at this location I'm shooting in 1 month's time. And I'm going to, and I was like, no, I can't even walk into the kitchen right now. Yeah. I was like, walk into the kitchen, Travis. What are you doing? Why are you walking to the kitchen? I can't. And I went outside and I was like, well, that was unexpected. And, you know, I had to talk myself up. And it's like you said, it's that you're not in control. You just have this sense of this is a terrible idea. Mm. Go. Get away. Leave. So, yeah.
And yet you didn't.
Yeah. You shot a whole movie. You still shot a whole movie.
I made an offering to the house that night
that
seemed appropriate. And we got through the shoot.
I'd love to hear a little bit about Festival Circuit, because then you take the film on the road. You've already played a few places. We were just talking off air. It's going to be playing in both the places we're headed in this next month.
Yeah.
So I actually – one thing I was reticent was to even watch it, because the reality is I want to see this on a screen. Yeah. And even more so after I watched it, I was like, oh, yeah, no, I need to see this again because it is actually made for a screen. It feels like a bigger movie in that way to me. So luckily we'll have Salem and Knoxville. But obviously it's traveling a lot. How much of that – how important is for the filmmaker to go with the film, to be there, and then to have those conversations after.
Well, you won't click on it on VOD if it doesn't play a festival. Yeah, that's so true. It's very important.
And yet I clicked on your screen.
No, it is. I think it is how you will establish yourself. It is how you'll make relationships that will provide fruit for a long time, like collaborators, actors, other filmmakers, writers, other festival programmers. So it's invaluable. I think it's also important in the conversations, both the conversations you have with other people so they can understand your intentions a bit more, and what they're saying to you about their reaction to it can be really informative to you and help you improve. So I think it's something that's important. It probably becomes less important the further along in your career you are, because maybe the movie can speak for itself, or people know you and know your work enough that they don't need as much context. Like Ty West could probably just do one festival, the premiere, and then go wherever he wants or somebody. For me, it's gotten a bit exhausting because so many of the festivals are sort of like a lifestyle thing as well as a film festival. So I'm trying to sort of spread myself out where it's like, I got a chance to make a movie, which is great. And I am so honored that it's playing in this city, in this city, in this city. But I need to sit at my desk for 12 hours a day and work on writing the next movie. Otherwise, all I'm going to have at the end of this opportunity is a beer gut and a bunch of stamps on my passport.
But I mean,
I say that as somebody who spent 10 years being able to, like, I've been able to travel to so many festivals that it's been incredible and it's made my career. I'm not trying to diminish it.
No, but I even see when I see Fantastic Fest pictures, and I go, oh, it's a 25-year-old's lifestyle. Like, you know, at a certain age, that's hard to maintain.
And it's,
and you're not really meant to maintain that.
Yeah, and it's like, and like, you know, say, fuck you, Travis, for like being like, oh, it's like, no, it is working for who it's supposed to be working for, and that's great.
But Josh Ethier.
we can hardier, put a name. Hardier men than us.
Josh can go from festival to festival like a bulldozer and still talk about Tarkovsky. That impresses me.
I know. I mean, he's actually one of my favorite people to follow, because like the recommendations coming out of Fantastic Fest are so – he's talking about the movies nobody else is. And I'm like, that's the movie I'm going to watch.
Yeah.
Wow.
But yeah, I mean, I think yeah, whatever. The home festival is a bit easier where you can go and you can see, you know, a few movies a week. It's not so much about everything around the movies. That can be exhausting. But yeah, I mean, I highly recommend, obviously, Fright Fest, Seachius, Fantasia, South by Southwest, Fantastic Fest, Tribeca, Fantaspoa.
And next week's festival.
And Beyond Fest.
Yeah. We have to throw that in because you're...
Those are the big ones.
Yeah.
Right? But those little ones like Chattanooga and Brooklyn and Knoxville you were talking about and Popcorn Frights in Florida and Overlook. I guess Overlook's not maybe a little one. But that's where the curation is so good that you're just the entire time you're just seeing magic from around the world that I still get super excited about those. And also it's sort of a... smaller town vibe. So you're really sort of spending your time there with a group of people that are kind of like your friends at the end of the experience.
And purely about the, like when I've gone to those, I've been so impressed by it. It's purely about the movies. It's not about celebrity.
Exactly.
And some of these become about celebrity or it, and even if unintentionally.
Yeah. Right? And I raise this not because the big festivals are not great. I just raise it because those small festivals could really use your submissions as well. They're looking for good stuff and they're going to be great for you. And you're going to come out of there not feeling totally overwhelmed.
Yeah.
So
one major thing I'm curious about is like the future. So I know Snowfort still exists, right? Snowfort Pictures is still whatever you make is. So you're directing now, I assume, because the thing that no one talks about in this industry, which I find fascinating and the hardest thing to work out for each individual is how to make a living. Because people misunderstand at home, like they probably think we, as podcasters, they probably think we're doing, working for Blumhouse.
We've
they
got
think
it means day jobs, trust me.
But it's like, you know, and I remember this for me was made crystal clear from Ty West mostly because I remember just after the second film going, wow, gangbusters, and then realizing, no, you have to still sell jeans or whatever the fuck it is, right? Is often you're making one thing every couple of years or you know, for a director, maybe not a producer. You probably have to keep it going. A, how do people make a living? But B, also like for you, are you going to now look at, you know, directing films and producing films and like trying to just do it all and then see what builds? Or do you do right now, do you have a new vision of what you're trying to get done?
It's a good question. I decided the best model for me would be like a Duplass Brothers thing where hopefully the films I write and direct can be at a level that has enough resources that can sustain me. And then I can use those relationships to help produce people on their way up who are making movies for 50 or 100 or 200 K. And I don't need to look at those as how I'm going to pay my rent because I'm being paid by the bigger movie I directed.
Yeah.
So that would be ideal financially. Creatively, it's really, really hard to read somebody else's script right now when I'd rather be writing my own. But yeah, I mean, I this is something like we had I hosted a panel on it at South By called Is This Normal? Like, I think this is the dirty secret of the film business is because so much of it's built on this illusion of like, I'm the girl or I'm the guy who's got the secret to make you a lot of money. Like, nobody wants to be open and honest with what the economics really are. And I find that that handicaps people from actually being able to make stuff. It's like, let's all be as honest that you don't want to be tacky, but it's like, yeah, no, I work a day job or I film this movie over the course of 2 years on weekends or whatever. And I only, you know, we sold it. Yeah, but we only got this. Like, I think that type of information informs people and allows them to take some of the pressure off themselves that this illusion is creating. And you know, I don't know a filmmaker even at the level of names you would recognize who isn't sort of worried about, you know, the next paycheck. I don't know at what level you get beyond that. And by next paycheck, I mean just like, am I going to be able to do this again?
Yeah, I think you just move on to new problems. Like you get into the Nick Cage, I got that island. I got to support that island. I got to support the snake, whatever it is, you know. Everyone, yeah, we all have our own. But I find it fascinating to hear that because I think that is an inspiring thing. And I think the one thing that you've always the way you've always gotten films made has always inspired me. But when you cited Mark Duplass, I remember the one line that I've been kind of using as my mantra was whatever his Southwestern talk was, which was the cavalry is not coming for you. Yeah. And I think when I deal with it, also being someone who's trying to get something made, but also dealing with younger students and stuff, you have to just remind them like the only person who's going to get it done is you. And yeah. no one else is coming and no one really cares. Even if they do care, they don't care enough to go and save you because yeah. they got their own shit to deal with.
Yeah, it's much more The Revenant than like Battle of Little Bighorn. metaphor. But yeah, I mean, listen, there are people who are like, I'm going to write something to sell to this big studio.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to spend all my energy nurturing relationships with people that will get me that paycheck. And that is its own skill set, and that probably has been successful for some people. But I would imagine the amount of effort it requires and the amount of payoff that happens is significantly less than if you just put that energy into making something with your friends. So if you want to make movies, go and make movies, and the other shit will happen. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, we also having had Joe and Josh on recently, you know, just seeing you just keep doing it. They kept doing it with whatever money they had and each time, and now they're getting to a point where it's starting to pay off, you know?
Yeah, for me, you know, it's funny because for me, again, there are people that do have that skill set that can make that goal, whatever it is, like I'm going to do it by doing this. But for me, it always boils down to you have to ask yourself a question when you do any creative thing is, wouldn't it be cool if ... And what the answer to that question is. Like every creative endeavor I've done is not for the money or whatever. It's I don't know what else I would do. I'm like, wouldn't it be cool if we did something like this or if we told that story or we worked with that person? And if you're not asking that, then I don't know why you would do it. That's just my own philosophy.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, and I mean, you guys talk with a lot more filmmakers than I probably do, more intimately. I meet filmmakers all the time where I'm like, why are you doing this? Like, what is the drive? What drives you when you wake up in the morning? Because it doesn't seem to be art based. Doesn't seem to be sort of communicating something of value. It just seems like you just decided you want to be a filmmaker. And it's like, well, what are you drawing your inspiration from then? And where do you think this is going to lead to?
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know. It used to be maybe you'd end up in TV, but like now, I don't know what you do with that sort of mindset.
Yeah, I mean, I get fueled by other people's art. I didn't know you did the Instagram thing, which is find other artists. And, you know, my buddy Scott Reynolds, shout out, who does TV stuff. He taught me early on. He was writing on one of the biggest shows on Showtime, and he'd be like, we're going to go to the New Beverly tonight to see Kung Fu Cannibals and have pizza. And it's like, you got to remember why we're creating for. You got to go and get inspired and hang out with your friends and have life experience to tell about life experience. And I've always remembered that. It's like always make time to get together with your friends, watch movies, check out art, whatever it is, because that fuels the art that we create.
Yeah. And like one of the things we started doing this year was maybe this is a little inside baseball, but getting out of the LA horror high school thing and actually having dinner parties where you could have an actual spend quality time with friends and really have deeper conversations beyond like, oh, did you see blah, blah, blah? Or you hear so-and-so's doing this or to like really dig deep into life. That's going to be so much more inspiring than just, well, I got a relationship with this guy and maybe we could put him in the movie and it'll look cool.
Yeah, people underestimate that can make you actually feel bad. Those short conversations can actually make everyone feel bad and everyone feels like they're competing. But the reality is you're not competing with anyone but yourself, but it doesn't feel like that, especially in a pool like this, you know, which is fascinating. But well, hopefully some people get inspired by this. And
they better.
Be inspired.
Be inspired. Because
I'm always inspired. I am, by these conversations.
Too. And so for those in LA, you get to see.
It's going
to
be, Carl the Third Floor is playing at on October 1st. At Beyond Fest here in Los Angeles. Yeah. You can catch it. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say that's the day after this episode airs.
Or oh,
day
is it?
Before. Day before.
Wait, no, this airs at the end of the week.
It airs Friday.
Oh.
Friday, yeah.
Well, then I won't do your job for you.
Yeah, no, that's okay.
I have no idea what time it is.
I don't even know what day it is.
Yeah, 24th.
You can still see it. Yes, no, it's a few days after this airs.
It's probably sold out though, right?
Los Angeles. Not yet.
Oh, what?
Okay. Not yet. You can go, and Travis will be there. Uh-huh. And then we're going to Salem and Knoxville and is playing at both.
Yep, I'll definitely be seeing it. Salem, I'm not sure about on the timing. Definitely going to see everything in Knoxville because we're there the whole time.
Yeah,
so,
that'll be fun. And this comes out October 25th for everybody
else. It comes out October 25th. It's at Brooklyn Horror Festival, I think October 23rd or 22nd. It's at Telluride Horror Festival and also Wyoming, WYO Sheridan Film Fest before then.
Are you at any of them? Beyond?
No.
Beyond Fest?
Yes, Beyond Fest. No, I'm at Brooklyn. Sorry, Brooklyn. With Phil Brooks and Trieste Kelly Dunn, who plays his wife. Yeah, that's it. It's been a wild year.
That's it, man. There's nothing more to talk
about.
You're
almost at the finish line. And yeah, no, thanks so much for coming in. We're glad we had you again on this show.
Yeah.
And hopefully it won't be another iteration.
Well, and you can, and if you want to hear origin story stuff, because we did skip that probably just because we've already done this, go back to that old Killer POV because a lot of it was about, you know, coming up and how you fell into the biz. And
Yeah. All that stuff's boring. Yeah. Just watch the movie and let's just talk about that stuff.
Yeah. Your best bet, by the way, is just search Killer POV Travis Stevens on YouTube. They're all on YouTube. We are figuring out a way to get those episodes back to you soon.
All right. Awesome. All right.
Thanks, Travis.
Thanks, guys.